You're listening to the Mission Church Podcast. Each message comes from our Sunday morning gatherings where we worship in community, study God's Word, and grow in our faith together to the glory of Jesus Christ. The Mission Church is committed to helping each person belong and believe and to equip them to embrace the call of God upon their life. We pray these messages will build your faith and encourage you today.
So here we are in this study tonight, and the title of the message, what I want us to really hold on to, is the power of godly vision. Godly vision. What does that mean? Well, we're going to unpack it tonight. I hope you're going to see it really clear by the end of the night. Without godly vision, we will self-destruct. It's only a matter of time. But with godly vision, we will have wisdom and discernment and be able to really be used by God in incredible ways. But it all centers around having a godly vision. I want you to think of a word for me. I want you to think of the word paradigm. And let me hear from you. What does paradigm mean? Paradigm.
Principle, structure.
What was that, Mick?
Structure.
Structure.
Principle behind
something. What was that, Chris?
How you see things.
How you see things. Awesome. Worldview. Awesome. A paradigm is how you see something. If I had a can of soda up here and I held it this way, not this way, but this way, and I said, hey, I want you to draw that on your paper, you would draw what? What would you draw?
A perfect circle.
And if I asked you, I said, hey, are you sure that's what you want to draw? Are you sure you got it accurately? You'd say, yeah, Dave, what do you think I am, an idiot? Yeah, it's a circle, just like this, man, just it's a circle. And then I said, man, are you sure? Dave, quit asking me. Yes, it's a circle. Now leave me alone. And then I turned it this way. You'd go, what would you say? Oh, let me redraw that thing. Now if I draw it, I draw a cylinder, and I'd say, why? Because your paradigm changed. You have a different paradigm. And having a godly paradigm, having godly vision is essential for making it through this life with wisdom. Making it through this life thriving and excelling and accomplishing all that God has called us to do. We simply cannot do it without a godly paradigm or without godly vision. In the 1950s, there was a doctor named Kurt Richer from Harvard, and he was a behavioral scientist, and he studied rats. And he put rats in a glass of water, and he wanted to see how long they could live, how long they would survive when they couldn't rest on anything, nothing to put their feet on, just swimming. Here's a picture of it, kind of gross. How long do you think a rat would last in a glass of water? 15 minutes was right on. They lasted 15 minutes on average. And it was really, really... Was that just a guess?
No.
It was just... Got a lot of experience. I'd hate to be one of your kids. No, just joking. Obviously read this. They lasted for an average of 15 minutes, and it was across the board. It wasn't just a one-time deal. Several tests, 15 minutes, they drowned. He did something interesting. At the end of 14 minutes, he pulled them out and let them sit on a plank for 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, he dunked them back into the water again. How long do you think they swam after he dunked them back into the water? 1 minute?
30 hours.
60 hours. 2.5 days. 240 times. their previous limit. He was shocked. Repeated the test. Same results. How do you explain that? How do you explain it?
Quick learning curve.
That is a paradigm shift. They go from being hopeless, thinking there's no way they can make it, to thinking, I can do this. There's going to be a plank coming. And it shows us the power of having the right paradigm. Having the right paradigm is incredibly powerful. It can increase your strength 240x on these particular things. And I just think it's incredibly insightful for us to look at. Jesus said it this way. He said the lamp of the body is what? The eye. And if your eye is single, if your eye is focused, if your eye is seeing things correctly, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye isn't seeing things correctly, your whole body will be full of what did Jesus say?
Darkness.
Darkness. And you know what happens when you walk in the darkness? What happens? You stumble, you fall, and ultimately people get hurt. So important that we have the right paradigm in life, that we have the right vision. We know this. 1 John 5 tells us that the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. That he comes and he wants to change our paradigm. He wants to change, take us from having a godly vision and to have a vision that is contrary to God's path. The whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 tells us that the God of this age has blinded the minds of those who don't know Christ, lest the glorious liberty of the gospel of Jesus Christ would transform them. The God of this age, who's the God of this age? Jesus taught very clearly Satan is the God of this age, and that he has blinded or taken away the proper vision of unbelievers, and he wants to do the same for us. We pick up our story in with David's life. And several years have passed since David was anointed by Samuel. Several years have passed since David was anointed as the future king of Israel. And they have been difficult years. He is tired. He is weary. King Saul is hell-bent on killing David. Saul is a slave to his own sin. He is blind and stubborn. He will not have a godly vision. He only will hold on to his vision. And he is prideful, and he's out to get David. David has been running for years. He has lost his friend Jonathan. He has lost his other friends. He has lost his wife. Think about how hard that would be. I talk with families all the time, husbands and wives, and when they're going through it, when they're really going at it, man, it wears you down, doesn't it? Think about how David would be being pulled from his wife lying to her father, saying, David tried to kill me, and not even standing up for him. And David is separated from his friends, separated from his wife, separated from fellowship, and he's running and not having a house to live in, not knowing when this future that God has for him is going to ever come into existence. Everything looks horrible right now. Nothing seems to be working. And David is growing weary. David is getting tired. David is lonely. And David is losing his vision. And that's what we see where we pick up in our chapter tonight, chapter 21. Follow along with me. Give me a big amen if you're there. Chapter 21, verse 1. David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. You might want to write the words there, the high priest. Ahimelech is the high priest of Israel. And Nob is about 12 miles from Jerusalem. And David is going to the high priest. We see this in David. He's going for godly counsel. I love that about him. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David. And he said to him, "Why are you alone? And why is no one with you?" Kind of unusual for a guy as powerful as David to be on his own. Looks suspect. And Ahimelech is wise. He's going, "Hey, what's going on here?" So David said to Ahimelech, the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place." Any of that true?
No.
A total lie. David is just flat out lying. No other way to say it. Verse 3. "Now therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever you can find." What do we learn about David in verse 3 right here? He's hungry. What are we learning about his life right here? Okay, but about what his daily life is like. What's his day? He's got nothing, man. He's got nothing. And imagine doing this for a week. Imagine doing it for a month. Imagine doing it for 5 years. And now you can kind of put yourself in David's situation. He doesn't even know where his next meal is coming from. He doesn't even know where he'll be sleeping tonight. And he's there looking for, you know, for a meal. Verse 4. "And the priest answered David and said, 'There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread.'" Holy bread was bread that was used in the tabernacle. And we see here that David was going to the tabernacle. The holy bread was right inside the holy place, not the holy of holies, but the holy place where only the priest could go in. And there, right when you walked into the holy place, was a table of showbread, and there were 12 loaves of bread on that table. Why 12? 12 tribes of Israel. And it's called showbread. In the Hebrew, the word show is face. It's face bread, if you will. Why face bread? Well, it's a picture. The holy place was a symbol of where God dwelt. And having the 12 loaves there, one representing each of the tribes of Israel, were a place where God would meet and fellowship with his people. That was the imagery that God ordered, that God wanted us to see. And so he says, "Hey, there's only the holy bread here." And he says, "If the young men have at least kept themselves from women, I could give it to you," I guess. Verse 5, "Then David answered the priest and said to him, 'Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out.'" Yeah, David hasn't been with his wife in years at this point. So again, he's just fabricating the lie. "And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day." What they would do is they would take the showbread and they would replace it every Sabbath. It would stay there for a week, and then on the Sabbath they would replace it. So this was probably the Sabbath that David was there and the bread was getting replaced. And the priest said, "Hey, I can give you the leftover showbread that was taken out, even though it was supposed to be for the priest." And they gave it to him. So the priest gave him the holy bread. "For there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put the hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day. detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg. Sounds like it sounds like a bad guy, doesn't it? Doeg. And he was an Edomite. What do we know about Edomites? Who were they come from? Edom means red. They're from what?
Esau.
Yeah, Ram. They're from Esau, descendants of Esau. Not the chosen line, a different line, turned out to be an enemy against Israel. And he's an Edomite, and he's the chief herdsman who belonged to Saul. So he's taking care of this. This Edomite, this Doeg, he's taking care. He's the shepherd, the chief shepherd of King Saul. And we're going to see this guy's character and contrast the character of the shepherd God is looking for to the shepherd that Saul has appointed as his chief shepherd. Quite a contrast. Verse 8, and David said to Ahimelech, the high priest, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? David apparently not having any weapon with him at that time. For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me because the king's business required haste. I had to leave in a hurry. Again, just another lie, one after another. So the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah. There it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take it, for there is no other except that one. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. Very interesting. David there looking for a weapon, looking for some food, running scared, lying through his teeth. And we see David wobbling a bit, if you will. But on the other hand, we see something interesting. David is fatigued. David is tired. David is weary. And yet, where is David going? Where does he go when he's in this situation? He goes to the tabernacle. And so we see this contrast, right? David, in his heart, he wants to serve God. He's going to the tabernacle. That's where he goes for help. This is a constant theme in his life, right? He went to Samuel before. He went to Jonathan before. He's always going to godly men. This is a reoccurring thing in his life, right? This is what he does. He goes and he seeks out godly counsel. Went to Jonathan, went to Samuel. Here he goes to the tabernacle. He goes to Ahimelech. And by the way, you can tell a lot about a man by looking at what he holds on to when calamity strikes. What do you hold on to when things get really difficult? A lot of men turn to what when things get really difficult? Alcohol. A lot of men turn to drink. And just to deal with their pain, to deal with the problems, they drink it away. Some men don't turn to drink, but they try to intoxicate themselves in success. Marriage problems, family problems, and what do? They dive deeper into a career. They dive deeper into materialism and making money where success can be more easily measured and attained than in a family. Different things that we turn to. Some turn to the pleasures of the world, to toys, to entertainment, to sex, to partying, to all these different things. David didn't turn to any of these things. He turns to God. He's going to the tabernacle. He's seeking counsel. He wants godly fellowship in his life, but Saul has driven that away. But we see this reoccurring path of what David's intent is. Nevertheless, David is tired. He's drained. He's weary, and he's losing vision. And even though he's turning to the tabernacle, we see him walking in sin as he does so, which is an interesting dilemma until you've been a Christian for very long, right? And you know in your heart what you want to do, and yet somehow you find yourself taking shortcuts. And that's what we see with David here. What is David doing? Why is he lying? What is he, what's going on? We see David is moving from a place where he was, a vision, a place where he, do you remember David who walked onto the battlefield as cheese boy? And he sees the enemy against God's men. And he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the true and living God? And he's willing to, he tries to go around and encourage all the soldiers. And he's just like appalled that this pagan would speak against God. And then he goes and he takes him down. He could have had all the weapons of Israel, but he refuses them. He says, hey, the Lord is with me. When I was with, when I was taking care of the sheep and a lion came or a bear came, it's the Lord's battle. And he goes against Goliath, this giant, with what? What kind of weapon? Just a sling, fully trusting in the Lord. What has happened? David is losing his vision. And here we see something. David is in self-preservation mode. And may I say, that is always a dangerous place to be. Sin is always near when we are in self-preservation mode. You ever find yourself wanting to get in self-preservation mode? I do. You get pulled over by a cop. Did you know you were speeding? And what do?
Absolutely not.
No, I didn't know I was speeding. And that's a bold-faced lie. Why are we lying? Self-preservation mode, right? It's what happens. And self-preservation mode is always dangerous, man. Sin is near when we're there. We get into an argument with someone. Someone accuses us of something. We feel threatened. And we get into self-preservation mode. Maybe in our own marriage, the tension gets coming up and there's someone's unhappy and we get into self-preservation mode. Always a big mistake. You know what I have found in life? I have found if I try to defend myself, God will let me. Far better to let God defend you. Far better just to be forthright. What God wants to do in our life, what Jesus wants to do in our life, is to get us to a spot where we are not in self-preservation mode, where we are not worried about our future because we are trusting in God. And because we do, we walk in truth. You know why we don't say things that need to be said? Because we're in self-preservation mode, as we looked at last week, some of that, right? You know why that... We lie when we're in trouble because we're in self. And God wants to bring us into a place where we walk in truth, where we walk in light, where we're not in self-preservation mode. And as godly men, as men who are learning how to walk with God, we have to learn not to go into self-preservation mode, which is, by the way, our natural default. It's just what we're prone to do. And I know this to be true, man. If I go into self-preservation mode, God will let me. If I try to defend myself, God will let me. But here's what I found. He is a far better defender of me if I will let him. But he won't do it both ways. He won't say, I'll defend you. When you're trying to defend yourself, he'll say, oh, really? That's the way you want to go? Okay, good luck with that. And big difference. David's in self-preservation mode. He's weary. He's tired. We're going to see it gets even worse. Look at verse 10. David arose. He fled from before Saul, and he goes to Achish, the king of Gath. Where's Gath? What is Gath? Gath is enemy territory, specifically the Philistines, specifically the town of Goliath, the giant he defeated. And David now goes down to Gath. And for time's sake, I'm not going to read it with you. I trust that you did your homework. By the way, you'll get so much more out of the studies and out of the talks if you've read the chapters and done the homework. You'll be twice as blessed. But let me paraphrase what happens. He goes to Gath, and the king hears about it. He says, hey, look, I recognize that guy. That's David. I recognize that sword that he took to defend himself. And now the thing he took to defend himself is being used against him. Very interesting. I recognize the sword. I recognize the guy. That's the guy that they sang. David has killed, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed tens of thousands. He's the guy that wiped out our brothers and sisters and our town and our wives, and now he's in our town. The king says, bring him to me. And when they bring him to David, David is in total fear. He's worried about losing his life. And what does David do? You guys who read it, what does he do? He pretends that he's insane. He starts acting like a madman, clawing at the wood, spittle coming down from his face as, what is he in? He's in self-preservation mode. And I want you to get that mental picture of David lying, deceiving, acting like he's insane, spit coming down his beard, and how far, what a long journey from the path when he was anointed as a young boy as king of Israel. How different the two look right now, right? And so this is what is going on. You know, crazy to look at. David has lost his vision. David has lost the vision that he had of who is this uncircumcised Philistine that would defy the armies of the... He's lost that vision, and he's now in self-preservation mode. Here in chapter 22, we're going to see God intervene in a very strange way. David's at a low point right now, a real low point, and we're going to watch God do something powerful. Look at chapter 22. David therefore departed from there after he feigns madness, feigns insanity. He departs from there. That's from Gath, right? Enemy territory. And he departs from there and he escapes to the cave of Adullam. Everybody say the cave of Adullam. Who's he with when he goes to the cave of Adullam? Nobody. He goes there and he's alone. And there in the cave of Adullam, he will write some psalms. Psalm 142, if you want to read it, a great psalm of what David was meditating on. And there he starts, God starts to change his focus in the cave of Adullam. Went to Israel and I got to spend some time in the caves of Adullam. It's a barren area, just really dry, almost deserty, and there's these jagged cliffs and there's these tons of caves all in them. Some pictures for you on the screens. You can see can you see these caves in there? Can you see them? Those caves aren't ground level. To get in those caves, you got to be a rock climber, man. And this is where David went, and he's hiding out in these caves trying to preserve his life. And there he would start meditating, and God would start speaking to him, and he would start writing these psalms. Let's look at some more of the pictures. Go to the next one. What's interesting about the caves of Adullam is out of nowhere, there's these, like this waterfall. Check that out. And it's like magic. It's like water coming out of a rock. And that's where David is, and that's where he's hanging out all this time, right? So some interesting things to consider and to read those psalms. You can read Psalm 142, Psalm 56. All of those things were written in the caves of Adullam. And so he's there for a while. You might want to put a little line right here where the word so is. Some time passes. He spends some time there. And after a long period of time, his brothers and his father's house heard it, and they went down there, again, over time. And over time, verse 2, look at this. This is really interesting. Everyone who was in distress, I want you to circle the word distress. And everyone who was in debt, I want you to circle the word debt. And everyone who was discontented, I want you to circle discontented. They all start coming to David. All these guys. And everyone who was going through a divorce. And everyone who was fighting with their neighbors. And everyone who was sick and tired of this and that. They all start coming to David, right? And look what happens here. So he became captain over them. And there were about 400 men with him. Do you see what's happening here? What is God doing? God is bringing all these misfits to David. And God is saying, David, I want to change your vision. And David starts doing what David is naturally gifted at doing. He starts leading these guys. What do you mean you're talking about your wife did this and she's such a jerk and you can't believe how bad she is? Buddy, you need to be da-da-da. And he would just counsel them and guide them and build them. What do you mean you hate Israel and you hate that and you just don't like it? You need to humble your... And David would start counseling these guys. And here David was raising them up. Look at verse 3. So David went from there to Mizpah at Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you until I know what God will do for me. Here I find something very interesting. David's now got 400 guys. That happened over time. David's leading these guys. His parents now come to him. And David, what does he do? He wants to make sure his mom and dad are taken care of. He honors his mother and father. Just good character, right? And David starts leading. Leading these 400 men. Leading. He's the responsible one in his family. He's taking care of his mother and father. Verse 4. So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Verse 5. Now the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah. What do we see? Not only 400 misfits come to David. Not only his family and some relationships come to David. Who else comes to David here? The prophet. Do you see what God is doing? God is changing David's vision. And the prophet tells David something very interesting. What does he tell him to do? We just read it. What does he say to do? Leave here. Where's here? The caves of Adullam, and go to where? Judah. What kind of advice is that? What does that do for David? He's pretty safe in the caves of Adullam. What's going to happen if he goes to Judah? Is that a safe move or a risky move? It's a risky move. And look what happens. Who's telling him this, by the way? Who is it? The prophet. And so let's see what David does. So David departed and went into the forest of Herath. David, he goes in and he says, okay, if that's what you want, he goes. And he goes. And here's some things that I see here. David had a powerful paradigm shift. He's starting to see things differently. His vision is changing. He's seeing himself as a leader. God is changing David's paradigm. David was close to falling into a dangerous rut of self-preservation. And had he continued over time, continuing to just be in a mode of self-preservation, I want you to know he wouldn't have looked very, very different than Saul. He would have looked pretty much just like Saul did. But God is changing his vision. And it doesn't matter if we are a king or if we are a pauper. If we are living for ourselves in self-preservation mode, it will destroy us. And God takes David and says, David, no. I want you to build these guys up. I want you to start leading. And he brings 400 guys to him. I want you to take care of your family. I want you to get back into Judah. Hey, it's dangerous there, God. Yeah, but there's people there that you'll be able to, they'll have access to you, and you'll be able to lead them, and you'll be able to be the shepherd I'm calling you to be. You can't be a shepherd of my people when you're hiding out in a cave protecting yourself. I want you to get in and be with my people. Jesus said it this way, again, changing David's vision, a paradigm shift, giving him a change of focus, giving him a godly vision. Jesus said it this way, he who desires to save his life will what?
Lose it.
But he who loses his life for my sake will what? He'll find it. He'll find life and life abundant. And the prophet comes to him and says, David, you got to quit protecting yourself. Get in and lead the people. And he's going to find his life in doing it. This is God's way. God comes along and he changes David's paradigm. He gives them vision. Instead of living for self, he calls them to be a builder of men, a builder of these misfits. And by the way, these misfits, who did they become? They became the mighty men of valor. More specifically, they became the men who made up Israel's greatest army in the history of the world. The Bible would write of these men and who they would become, and it would speak of them saying their faces were like the faces of lions in battle. They were so courageous. They would do anything for David. They believed in God. Men like Joab, who had tremendous allegiance and God's favor on his life. Men who were renowned for their character and their walk. Built up by David, God is making these guys. He's equipping David with everything that he needs to be what? To be the king of Israel. And yet, doing it in the most unusual ways. Pretty incredible to look at how these men would become this. God is restoring David's vision. I'm sure you know this very well-known phrase, but Helen Keller was once asked, what could be worse than being born deaf, dumb, and blind? And her answer, do you remember it? What was it? To have sight, but not have vision. Wow, that's profound. To have sight, but not to have vision. And a life without vision eventually produces depression. People who commit suicide, they often feel like they have nothing to live for. Chronic depression is often caused by a lack of vision. And here we see the importance of having a right vision. By the way, most people have some kind of vision that guides their life. You have some kind of vision that guides your life. You may have not formulated it into a concise statement, but you probably have some kind of ideal, some kind of standard, some kind of master passion that you desire, whatever it may be, that is guiding your life. It may be wealth. It may be, you know, you just want to have really nice things, and that's what's guiding your life. It may be... that you want to have a great family and you're all about family and you put Instagram posts to make your family look great and it's all about great family. It might be that you have, the desire to be just super attractive and well-known or, whatever. You just want to be the center of attention, get special treatment and the admiration of others. But most people have some kind of vision that is guiding their life. I thought of some guys that had a vision. How about Junior Seau? Did he have a vision? Oh, absolutely. NFL great, 10-time All-Pro, right? What happened to Junior Seau? At 43 years of age, he takes his life. Ken Caminiti, National League MVP, right? I mean, amazing. Took steroids. Was found out the guilt overwhelmed him. Cocaine took over, and he loses his life at, how old, Greg?
Early 40s.
Early 40s, loses his life. Did these men have vision? Absolutely. What was the problem? Wrong vision. The abundant life does not come from having a lofty vision. It comes from having a godly vision. And we see the importance of a proper paradigm. And it begs the question, how's your vision? Jesus said, once again, the lamp of the body is the eye. How's your vision? What is it for you to be living? Is your vision in line with the will of God? Life is the most rewarding when our vision lines up with God's will. That's when life gets rewarding. God comes, and what is he doing? He's renewing David's vision. David, you're my king. David, you're a shepherd. Now walk like one. Get out there and lead my people. Yeah, but God, these guys are misfits, man. I mean, if I didn't have it bad enough, I can't believe it. I'm already running from Saul, and now I got all these retards coming out with me. I mean, what the heck? Wrong vision, David. Wrong vision. Take these men. Lead them. Disciple them. That was probably the wrong word to use. forgive me. But God is restoring David's vision. David, what are you doing in here in the caves of Adullam? David, get back into Judah and lead the people. And David lets God guide his vision. And I love this, man. God comes along and David gets vision from God again. And David is transformed from being a madman to being a man walking with wisdom as the future king of Israel. And this is what God loves to do, to give us vision when we're wobbling so we get back on track so that he can build us up and lead us in the right path. I want to look at what David does next and what Saul does next. Here we're going to see with Saul, King Saul has rejected God and chooses his own vision. And man, look how embarrassing it is, Saul's vision. Verse 6, where we left off, 22:6. Saul heard that David and the men with him had discovered... let me start over. When Saul heard David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah underneath a tamarisk tree in Ramah, and with a spear in his hand and with all his servants standing by him. Then Saul said to a spear in his hand just means ready to kill. Verse 7, then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" What is he appealing to them? Will he make you rich? Will he make you powerful? He's appealing to their flesh because that's all he has himself. He has nothing else to draw from. All of you have conspired against me. And there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. Who's the son of Jesse? David. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me. There's not one of you who feels sorry for me. Or who reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. How pathetic is this? And you see what happens when you lose your vision and you're only about self-preservation? This is how pathetic a man looks. It's ugly. Now we're going to see what he does is incredible. Verse 9, then Doeg, the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the high priest, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him. That was not true, by the way. That means he used the ephod and inquired, and that was something that was for the king to do, and David did not do that. He lies right there. He's giving this story, and he's putting a twist on it. And he gave him provisions. That was true. And he gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistines. That was true. By the way, why is Doeg saying all of these things? For what reason?
Self-promotion.
He's trying to get moved up to the right hand of the king, right? And all said for self-promotion. So the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's house. That means the entire lineage of Ahimelech. And all the priests who were at Nob. And they all came to the king. And Saul said, "Hear now, you sons of Ahitub." He answered, and they said, "Here am I, my lord," very humble. And Saul said, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, you and David, and that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?" And Ahimelech, that's the high priest, answered the king and said, "Who among all of your servants is as faithful as David?" Answer, no one. I love Ahimelech. He's not a yes man. He has wisdom. He's walking with God. And he stands up to Saul. Secondly, he's the king's son-in-law. He's your son-in-law, dude. And he goes out and he does your bidding. He cut off 200 foreskins of the Philistines single-handedly, right? Killed 200. And he's honorable in all your house. What's he saying? He's saying, listen, Saul, wake up and smell the coffee. David is the best man you have, right? Verse 15. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Or in other words, no, I didn't. Let not the king impute any such thing to a servant or to any of the house of my father, any of the other priests, in other words. For your servant knew nothing of this matter that you had a rub with David. He knew nothing of it, neither little or much. And the king said, read these words with me out loud. Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. Oh my gosh. Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priest of the Lord, because their hand is also with David, and because they knew when he fled, and they didn't tell it to me. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priest of the Lord. Good for them. Good for them. And men, may I say, we need men who will stand up when the government gives orders that are ungodly. We need men who will stand up. Verse 18, and the king said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priest. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priest and killed on that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. How long do you think it takes for one man to kill 85 men? Incredible, incredible. And if that was not bad enough, also Nob, the city of the priest, he struck with the edge of the sword both men, women, children, nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, goldfish, hamsters, everything with the edge of the sword. I find it just, this is the worst sin Saul has done to date. It's probably the worst sin he'll ever do in his entire life. This is worse than he does even at the end of his life when he goes to the witch of Endor. This is the very worst. I mean, just incredible abomination to God. By the way, King Saul was ordered by God to kill the Amalekites and to wipe them out. And what did he do? He saved them and their goods for himself. Here, he wipes out all of God's men and their animals, and man, just shows you, right? Now look at this. This is so cool. Verse 20. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. And David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all these persons of your father's house. Is that true? No, not true. This was Saul's wickedness, not David's. But I love this about David. What does David do? David takes responsibility. I love a man who will take responsibility, by the way. That is the mark of spiritual maturity. I hate getting excuses, but I love a man who stands up and says, hey, by the way, Pastor JC is a man like that. He'll stand up. He'll take responsibility for things, and I love that about him. It's the mark of spiritual maturity. And look what David says. Well, we're going to see a radical change here. I'm going to get you into your small groups in just a minute. Verse 23, stay with me. Who's he talking to? Abiathar, the priest. Stay with me. Do not fear, for he who seeks my life, seeks your life. But with me, you shall be safe. What's happening? David is getting renewed vision. And I want to jump into chapter 23. I want you to see some things. Look at this. Then they told David, saying, look, the Philistines are fighting in Keilah, and they are robbing the threshing floors. Keilah is right in the city of Judah. It's right there in town. And the Philistines are robbing the threshing floors. What does that mean? What are the Philistines doing? Taking all the harvest. And when you take all the harvest, do you know what that does? Not only does that make you bankrupt for this season, but it also makes you bankrupt for next season, because all the seed is in the harvest and they take all of it. You have no seed for your crops next year. And so there in this state, someone comes and tells David, the Philistines are doing this. And look what happens. Look what David does. Therefore, David, verse 2, inquired of the Lord and said, shall I go and attack the Philistines? And the Lord said to David, go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah. Underline the words, save Keilah. Go and do what a king should do. Save the people. Now, here's the question. How is David inquiring of the Lord? How is that even possible? How is God answering so clearly here? When you pray, do you hear that kind of answer? I don't. I live by faith, don't you? But David hears directly, emphatically from the Lord. How does that happen? Well, he's inquiring to who? To this priest. Look at verse 6 of 23, and look what we see. Now it happened when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David in Keilah, that he went down with a what? With an ephod in his hand. Do you know what an ephod was? An ephod was the breastplate plate that the high priest would wear, and on it were 12 stones. What do those 12 stones represent? Each one of the tribes of Israel. And those 12 stones, all of them were translucent stones, like a diamond. You know, what's the word? Thank you. Light. And they would inquire with a Urim and Thummim. And this wasn't for anybody to do. This was for a king to go to the priest, and God would lead the nation this way. And the king would go to the priest, and he would ask, should we do this? And they would use the Urim and Thummim, and one of these stones would light up, and it would give direction to what they were seeking. Very interesting if you're a Bible scholar to study this in the Garden of Eden. I wish we had time to go to it. But anyway, we see some things happening. Do you see what's happening? What's happening? God brings David 400 misfits, and he says what? Make him mighty men of God. And they become what? David's army. David sends him the prophet, and the prophet starts speaking truth into his life. David, get out of here and go down to Judah and do the work. And David does. God now sends him what? A priest. And that one priest who escapes just so happens to have what? The ephod. And now the king is inquiring to God. And David goes in and he wipes out the Philistines and he saves the land. And the kingdom is beginning to get established. One more thing I want to show you. 1 minute, and then we'll look at verse 7. When Saul was told that David had gone down to Keilah, Saul said, God has delivered him, that's David, into my hand. For he has shut himself in by entering a narrow town that has gates and bars. What did Saul think when David went down there? God's blessing me. I'm going to get what I want. Was God blessing Saul? Nothing could be further from the truth. And carnal believers will often think God is blessing them because I got this big deal, or because I'm on vacation at such and such, and look how God's blessing me. That is not the mark of God's blessing. God is not blessing Saul. Do you know who God's blessing? The guy who's running for his life, that doesn't have a place to lay his head. The guy who doesn't know how his next meal is going to come. The guy who is getting his vision renewed and now is walking in faith and doing God's work and discipling other men and pouring into others and honoring his mother and father and talking to the prophets and getting counsel from the prophets, and the priest is coming to him and he's inquiring of the Lord. That's the man that God is blessing. We just can't see it quite yet. Shall we stand?
You may freely share this message with others as long as you don't charge for it. Support for these broadcasts comes from your generous donations that allow us to give away our materials for free. To participate with us, please visit our website at themissionchurch.net. God bless.